KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. I'm Rusty Cannon, and I have the extreme pleasure tonight of co-hosting with the one and only Greg Skordas. Good to be with you, Greg.
It's nice
only
to be with you.
My second rodeo.
How did I get so lucky? Yeah.
It's
well, I've actually had a blast just talking to you, prepping for the show tonight. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thank you. It's going to be an exciting show. And real quick, for everybody, just to remind you that if you do miss a show at any time, you can always remember you can go back and listen to it on KSLpodcast.com after the show's been aired. Just look up KSL at Night and you're good to go. So we have an exciting guest in studio with us tonight. This is a real pleasure. Appreciate him joining with us. As you all know, Congressman John Curtis is running for the United States Senate, which opens up his House seat, which is Congressional District 3. There are quite a few candidates running, and we have the pleasure tonight of having one of those candidates with us, J.R. Byrd. Welcome to the studio with us, J.R.
Thank you, Rusty. It's a pleasure being with you tonight, Greg, as well. Thank you for having me on. This is a great opportunity.
It's really nice, I'll say this, when guests come into the studio and we can actually talk to you, and we'd like to actually hold you for two segments if you don't mind. I'm going to tell you that at the beginning, but we're going to keep you here for a while, okay?
That's okay.
You're captive.
Yeah, you're stuck with us for a bit. But so for listeners that just haven't learned about you yet, obviously I know you're mayor out in Roosevelt, Congressional District 3. You can talk about the geography, but first of all, introduce yourself to everybody so everybody can know who you are.
Sure. J.R. Byrd. I was born and raised in the Uinta Basin, and so a lifelong resident of Utah. If you're not familiar with the Uinta Basin, that's the heart of oil and gas country, mining country, you know, Carbon Emery. Really, we have a treasure over there in eastern Utah. So born and raised there, grew up relatively poor, but pulled myself up by the bootstraps and started my first business 16 years ago in the energy industry. Mm-hmm. And 10 years ago, got involved with politics, thought that, giving back to the community and things like that. The reason
it's a bug, isn't it?
Yeah. The reason why all people get involved with politics, right? So,
So what's got you interested in the congressional seat specifically?
You know, that's really interesting. That's a really good question, because this isn't something that I ever thought I would be doing. Mm. I thought, as mayor of Roosevelt, we implemented term limits. I'm in my second term and thought I'm done with politics. I give back. I did my civic duty. But I really felt strongly we needed somebody with, my experience in energy, with business and finance. And, you know, I've been a part of the Latin community for the last 8 years and understanding immigration and a lot of those things. And I see the problems we face as a nation, and I'm just not one to turn a blind eye to those. I'm one to not sit the sidelines, but to get involved.
So tell us about your campaign. I mean, Rusty mentioned you've got other opponents, and I don't pretend to know who they all are. I'm sort of leaned with the Democrats most of the time, and I don't know if we have anybody running, but there's probably somebody
there's
out there.
Two. I've,
okay,
I've heard there's two.
That's great.
So
okay,
you might have a chance.
But given that you've got convention coming up, you've got to start either reaching out to delegates or getting signatures. But what's your campaign look like right now?
You know, it's really, really healthy right now. We're doing really good. Reaching out to delegates. In fact, when I got invited to this show, I was on the phone with a delegate all the way up here. And so that's what it's all about, in my opinion, is reaching out to the public. When I ran for mayor, I knocked about 1,800 doors myself, going out and letting the people know why I was running. It's not about
winning.
That's
half of Roosevelt.
It's out of 2,700 households.
Yeah, it's so two-thirds, right.
That's a high percentage.
And this is an opportunity. The convention system gives you that same opportunity to really get to know people and them get to know you. And I think that's really, it's important when we're talking about elections to make sure that you know who's running and why they're running.
So you mentioned how busy you are. How many events a day are you doing at this point?
Today, this is my third, and I've got one more today. So,
okay.
Yeah, I was on a podcast this morning, then I had a town hall, then I have this, and then I have another one, a meet and greet tonight, and I've got two or three lined up tomorrow, and I've got one Sunday, and it's a busy schedule.
Tell us what CD3 looks like in terms of a map of the state. I mean, obviously, it's out in the basin.
Sure.
But it includes a lot of other areas than that.
It does. So you have about a quarter of Salt Lake County, the southeast corner of Salt Lake County, running down I-15 all the way to the southern point of 4th south in Springville, mm-hmm. and then it juts over towards the eastern part of the state. And then you have basically the whole eastern part of the state, except for on the northern end, half of Summit County. So it is a large geographical area.
You have quite a game plan for convention yeah. as well. Are you going the signature route as well?
We did go to the signature route. However, a lot of people have asked me, you know, why would I do that? And, you know, for me, if I'm going to do something like that, it's got to be done correctly. And we've really gone out with volunteers and myself and my wife. I have to give a shout out to her. She's the number one yep. signature gatherer for our campaign, by the way. And if we're going to do that route or take that route, we need to do it the right way. And that mm-hmm. is connecting with the people. Yeah. And, you know, there's some people that frown upon that, but I think done correctly, it can be a really good tool to educate the people of who I am and why I'm running. So,
JR, I want to say it seems like, and we're talking to JR Byrd, candidate for Congressional District 3. And I want to say this, it seems like Congress right now is, at least in terms of public perception, not high on the list. You know what I mean? It just seems like we're not getting a lot done there.
Right.
I assume if you're going to run, that's something that you're conscious of. That's something you want to change. You see what's going on there. What do you think you bring to Congress that we don't have now?
Well, one of the things that I did as mayor of Roosevelt is really unified the people there, got public involved, built coalitions and teams to really get things done. And I think that's what we need to have happen in Congress. We're so divided, not only as a party, but as a nation. And what I found, you know, campaigning throughout the state and throughout the district is we really do agree on a lot more than we disagree on. It's just that we've chosen these highly politicized, polarized issues to focus on, and that's really detrimental. So, and I'm a problem solver. I'm one that likes to fix things. And so, you know, looking at Congress, that is a challenge, and that's something that I want to correct and fix. And I think we can do that by building relationships, building coalitions, focusing on the things that really matter most, and forgetting about some of those fringe things that are just meant to distract and incite emotion in the general public.
So you mentioned you're out in the UN bases, and this is something I think is important for Wasatch Front listeners to remember is what's really out there, the oil and gas industry. It is big and important to the state. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's where you are and what you're involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's more than that. But oil and gas, for example, when Biden puts moratoriums on you know, permitting on public lands, that affects the whole state. A lot of that mineral lease money that's gained on those lands comes back to the state
yeah.
for funding for schools and things like that, schooling. And then it goes to other organizations like the Community Impact Board that helps, you know, several counties throughout the state with infrastructure projects and things like that that are impacted by energy. And so there's a large benefit that we get. But when it's impacted by a president like Biden who puts, you know, these restrictions on permitting and things like that, that affects every single one of us. The other thing I don't think people realize, and I didn't either until I became a member of the Central Utah Water Board, and that is hundreds of acre feet of water, or, you know, over 100 acre feet of water comes from Duchesne County into, you know, the Salt Lake Valley through the I forgot the name of it, but I'll remember it anyway, mm-hmm. through a project, the Central Utah
yeah.
Project.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, we are connected, very tightly connected, rural Utah and the Wasatch Front. And, you know, the decisions that are made really affect all of us.
That's important. So the good news is we're going to have more time to talk. So we're going to take a break and then we're going to come right back. KSL at Night, thank you for joining us. And we'll be right back with J.R. Byrd.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. Alongside Rusty Cannon, I'm your host this evening, Greg Scorza. We are joined again for the second segment by J.R. Byrd, Roosevelt Mayor. And I want to just ask you this question. Well, first of all, you mentioned your wife in the first segment. I want you to tell us briefly about your family, but then I also want you to tell us how a rural mayor can get the word out to people, because you have a lot to say and you were incredibly impressive during the first segment, but you got to come to Salt Lake County. You got to go to, some of the eastern counties of the state, maybe Grand County. I don't remember which other ones were in your district, but you went to Duchesne. You know, how do you get that word out? But tell us about your family first.
Yeah, sure. So Brindy Byrd is my wife, been married to her for 23 years. We have four wonderful children. The youngest is a sophomore in high school. He'll be graduated in a couple of years. And this is why I said I was thinking.
You don't look old enough to have four kids that are the youngest. Well,
she's actually in Las Vegas right now with our second oldest daughter, who is going to give birth hopefully within a week or so. So our first grandchild is
good
on the way.
Good for you.
But well, so in addition to your family getting involved in things, obviously you need to start weighing in on issues. And there's a lot of issues that are hot topics right now, I'm sure, as you're talking with delegates at this point. The first one you'd mentioned in the first segment, issues out in the basin with we're all affected by immigration, right?
Yes.
And what's going on with the southern border. We could have an hour long conversation about that. But what are your thoughts on the immigration issue?
The biggest frustration I see with immigration right now is the fact that we already have the laws in place to stop the illegal migration or immigration coming into our country. It's the simple fact is Biden is not enforcing the policies and the laws that are already in place. And so this is one of the we've deviated from the Constitution and we've really weaponized the executive branch to create policies and things like that, where the laws that are in place really would protect that. And they've used a provision in the law called parole to parole hundreds of thousands of people into our country, which is completely wrong. And the parole clause has only been utilized 8 to 10 times a year prior to the Biden administration. And it's on a case-by-case basis. But the fact that they're doing that is wrong. We need to hold them accountable. If you look at the Homeland Security report, and there is an impeachment happening with Mayorkas right now, it's already made it through the House. It's at the Senate, I believe, still. And that's why they're impeaching him, is because there's been two court orders. They've already identified where he's in breach of the law, and nothing's really happening. And that's one of the biggest frustrations that I see. But the lack of the executive branch's willingness to secure the border is really affecting all of us, and it's made all of us border states. And my heart goes out to Governor Abbott in Texas. I mean, they're really facing the brunt of this, but it's something that we have to rein in, and Congress has to regain control of that.
By doing what? I mean, how does Congress get control of that again? We have a White House that's not doing what most Americans think he should be doing with the border. What can you do in Congress?
This is what's really, really difficult. And the courts have gotten involved a little bit, but this is what's difficult. And I've read this to a degree, and there's not a lot that you can do except for impeachment. And I know nobody wants to hear the word impeachment. They're tired of this word being thrown around, but it's really difficult to enforce the executive branch or make the executive branch and hold their feet to the fire to actually execute these things. And so that is the difficulty right now. They're going after Mayorkas. How we get the president to do this, public pressure, we need people to understand really what's at stake here and to know that the laws are there. It's just simply that the president has refused to execute.
So one other hot topic that comes up is spending, right? The budget. Yeah. Your thoughts on that big ball of wax, because there's a lot of fighting going on over that.
It seems like we have a near shutdown every 6 weeks.
Oh, this one really rubs me wrong, because I'm all about process, and the border is definitely something that is a big issue, but this budget issue is the most difficult one to solve. It is a ball of wax. But really what you look at, if we would just start by following the budgetary process that's in place, that would help tremendously. One of the things that I would like to push, a piece of legislation, would be to tie Congress's hands, meaning they don't get to work on anything else unrelated to the budget until the budget's passed. Can you imagine? And the thing of it is by legislating and doing these things, they're indirectly affecting the budget anyway. So just stop all that. Focus on the budget. This is your number one most important responsibility. When you get that out of the way, then you can start legislating other things.
Yeah, it's interesting. The appropriations process, it seems so broken. It's supposed to work orderly, the different pieces chopped up. They go through it and do it throughout the year, and then it's all buttoned up by September. So
should be.
Essentially, we've been on a CR, a continuing resolution, forever at this point, it seems like. But in addition to the budget, that made me think of one other question. Have you thought about committees that you would want to be on, right? We have Congressman Moore's on Ways and Means, a very powerful committee. But have you thought about the committees that you'd like to serve on?
I have. And there's three that I've identified that I would really like to serve on. First of all, energy, and natural resources, that's one that fits directly with the things that we face in CD3. So I think that would be an important committee to serve on.
And that you face in your own jurisdiction.
Exactly. And it's really my wheelhouse. It's,
right.
These are things that I know and understand very, very well. But the other thing, because I am all about process and transparency and accountability, the Oversight Committee is one that I would really like to serve on, because that's how we get, you know, the corruption rooted out of government. That's how we identify the problems and really start to fix internally these things that are causing a lot of the problems in our nation. So that's another one. Small business is one, because being a small business owner, I see that they're the ones that get, they have the biggest weight to carry, and with regulations and taxes and everything else. And they're the number one job creator for America. We should be making policy to help them, incentivize them, and we're almost doing just the opposite. And I've seen that personally in my own life. And so those are three that definitely.
So let's pivot a little bit, since you talked about the budget. It seems like Congress's interest in supporting some wars overseas, and I'm talking about Ukraine, I'm talking about Gaza, I'm talking about what level of support the United States should have when we're talking about, at least in Ukraine, and we had a guest last night on this show, the Ukraine ambassador to the United States, who really talked about the importance of that. Of course, she's selling that. Of course she is. Mm-hmm. But what role do you want the U.S. to play in conflicts like that?
Well, I think there is an interest for the U.S. to be there. Obviously, we want to make sure that Russia doesn't invade or take over Ukraine. I know, you know, a lot of people are concerned that China is going to take over Taiwan next, and they're just looking to see how this conflict works out. But there's definitely a national security interest for the United States and Ukraine. However, we have to have a clear objective, in my mind, to win that war if we're going to be there. And two, we can't send unfettered funds there. As a businessman, when you have a goal or an objective, you incrementally move towards that. And if you see the needle moving with what you're doing, then you continue. And if not, you've got to pull back. One of my biggest frustrations with this conflict, though, and if it is our objective is to win the war with Russia, then why did we have a president put a freeze on LNG exports to Europe? So if we don't supply Europe with their gas and our allies, then they've got to purchase it from Russia. So indirectly, we're enriching Russia, all the while we're sending funding to Ukraine. So we're not fighting a coordinated battle there. And this is one of the biggest frustrations that I see. Plus, the president doing that is outside of his bounds, in my opinion, because in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, it says, you know, Congress is to regulate commerce between nations and states. And so it's almost hypocritical to say we're going to send money to Ukraine to fight this war and then indirectly fund Russia because we're unwilling to send our gas over there. So we've got to fight it in a coordinated way, and we're currently not.
Well, JR, this has been fascinating for us, and I think for our listeners as well. We appreciate you being willing to come on KSL at Night, and we wish you the best of luck. We know campaigning is very difficult on a family, on anybody, especially that delegate process right now. It's a bit of a crucible,
right?
We know, but very impressive. We appreciate you coming on. Thank you for joining us. Everybody, stick with us here on KSL at Night. We will be right back after this break.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm your host, Greg Skordas, alongside Rusty Cannon. And if you have any breaking news or you want to be involved in breaking news, just text BREAKING, BREAKING, to 57500. I set that up, Rusty, a couple days ago, and I get breaking news all the time. It's really interesting. You know, things that you kind of don't expect, and suddenly there you are, including some news today. Just, I don't know, this is heartbreaking news, but
it is.
Another student, this time a student at Roy High School, is caught bringing a gun to school. Says quick action by school resource officer averted a potentially dangerous situation. School officials acted on a tip that a student had brought a handgun to school with him. Now, I don't know why a student would bring a handgun to school. And this one's really troubling because they interviewed the Roy City Police Department and said, you know, you always wonder, how does a student get a gun? A lot of people have guns. I'm in that category myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have firearms, but boy, you got to lock them up. They interviewed one of the Roy City Police officers who said this about how the student got the gun.
The boy got the weapon by stealing the key to his family's safe.
They only had a key to it, so it wasn't like a keypad. It wasn't necessarily most of the secure safe, in my opinion.
So, Rusty, just in terms of legally, we try to protect our family, our schools, our kids from firearms, and so we encourage people to use a safe, to have a gun safe. I think one that is accessed by a single key, it probably isn't really a gun safe.
No. I mean, if a key is in plain view, what have you, what's the point of the safe, right? I mean,
right. But I also understand this because a lot of people ask me about, well, what are you supposed to do with a gun? Because a lot of people feel, and Utah is one of those stand your ground states, we have the right to firearms, we have a right to have protection, and some people have a firearm near their bed.
Yeah.
Some people have it because some people will tell me this, what good is a firearm to me if an intruder comes, if it's in my safe, if it's in the basement, if I have to do a keypad to get to it? And I completely understand that. But the rules change a little bit when you've got children in the home.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that there's got to be some higher level of scrutiny, some higher level of care to what parents do when they deal, when you have firearms in your home. I mean, I have firearms in my home, but they're in a safe. They would be useless to me if somebody came to the house.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't access them in a million years. But I have them. I enjoy them. I just sort of collect them because I think they're fun. I think they're interesting.
So from your perspective as an attorney, where do you draw the line? I mean, as far as parental responsibility, like in this case, it sounds like parents have the guns in a safe, keys in plain view. Access was granted. Apparently a loaded gun was taken to school. Like, where do you draw the line on parental responsibility at this point?
Yeah, you know, anytime you look at something like that, Rusty, you look at what we call reasonableness. What does a reasonable parent do to protect their citizens, their neighbors from the firearm? And and what reasonable people do is they lock them up. They have them in a secure place. They don't allow people to have them. They're the children to get them. Is it reasonable to have them in a lockbox that's accessible by a key that's visible? You know, that's a closer call. But you know what's really interesting? We recently had this case, the Ethan Crumbly case in Michigan, which, as far as I know, legally is the first time parents have been held criminally responsible for the acts of a mass shooter. We don't see that. And the state of Michigan decided, wait a minute, we're going to file criminal charges against parents.
Yeah.
For the act of Ethan. I think he killed four people in Michigan. Mom went on trial a couple of months ago. She was convicted of four counts of what we call involuntary manslaughter, which is, Utah has a statute called manslaughter, which is a little bit different than involuntary manslaughter, but it's similar. And that crime in Michigan carries 15 years in prison, the same as our manslaughter, 1 to 15.
Yeah.
She was convicted. She got four 15-year sentences. Dad was recently convicted. And here's what one of the kid's parents said at his sentencing to that father.
Not only did your son kill my daughter, but you both did as well. You failed as parents. The punishment that you face will never be enough. It will never bring her back. It will never be a loss that you have suffered, and it will never heal the pain. Your Honor, I request that the maximum sentence be enforced, as it will never come close to the life sentence I was given.
And I think that's exactly what happened, Rusty. I think that the judge gave the father the four 15-year sentences that was requested.
So those
here
be consecutive sentences?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, consecutive, concurrent, you know,
concurrent.
We have different. Yeah, I'm sure they were consecutive. I'm sure they were one after the other. It's just that when you deal with the prison system, sometimes they don't just 15, 30, you know, 45, 60.
So is this going to set a precedent where, I mean, this seems like a bit of a seismic shift, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And that's a good point, because whether that's going to set a precedent when we come out here to the Wild West, where guns are much more accessible and much more acceptable, it remains to be seen. But certainly I think parents and sometimes we've seen where people who sell firearms or manufacturers of firearms are more and more coming into the crosshairs of civil suits, that type of thing. But in terms of a criminal suit, this is really one of the first ones. And whether that's going to carry further, I don't know. If you remember the Crumbly case, this kid, I think he was 15, just a young kid. He had all kinds of emotional problems. He was drawing pictures of taking a gun to school. His parents were really nonchalant. The mother, even during her own trial, was very flippant about the whole thing. It didn't bode well for her with the jury. But they were actually brought to school on the day of the shooting. Mm-hmm. Mom and dad were and said, hey, something wrong with your kid. They're like, yeah, you know, he's fine. Don't worry about it. He'll be fine. And, you know, before they even get to work, they're getting a call that he's got a gun and he's killed four people. So in that case, you know, when we consider the law, the criminal law, Rusty, mm-hmm. we have homicide statutes. And our homicide statutes in Utah and Michigan are very similar. We say that if you intentionally cause the death of another person, that's murder. Mm-hmm. Now, that obviously didn't happen here from the parents' perspective. They didn't intend to cause death. But then we also say almost every state has a manslaughter statute, which states that if you recklessly cause the death, that you're criminally responsible. It's not the same as murder where you get a 20 to life.
Yeah.
It's a manslaughter where you get a 1 to 15. But what we're looking at is, and what a jury would decide in a case like that is, was it reckless conduct on the part of the parents to allow that kid to go to school that day or to give him access to the gun? I think they even bought him a gun, or I don't remember the exact circumstances of it. But the jury in Michigan unanimously agreed. Yes, that was reckless conduct, and they've been charged, they've been convicted, and now they're both imprisoned for the conduct of their kid. I mean, he's going to be messed up the rest of his life. I mean, he's doing a life sentence without the possibility of parole, probably, for four homicides, even though he was just a minor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kid's never getting out. But yeah, I don't know if it's going to set precedent. I mean, it certainly was bold on the authorities there in Michigan to bring criminal charges against parents for the act of a child. We really don't see that. Mm-hmm. You know, we really don't see that under our law when kids are, you know, causing harm to others, graffiti, stealing cars, that kind of a thing. But in this case, I think there was just enough misconduct and problems on the part of the parents where the authorities said, we're going to charge you.
So what happens in this Roy case at this point, in your view?
Yeah, well, so this one's a little different because he had a gun. No one was hurt. Law enforcement got in. They stopped him. They seized the weapon. So, and you got to hand it to law enforcement. And I guess it was a school resource officer there in Roy High that just nipped it in the bud right away.
Yeah.
What liability or what do we look at for the in terms of the parents? I don't know. I mean, it's probably not criminal because nobody was hurt. There was no harm.
Yeah.
But I would think that, you know, I could see maybe people going into their home and saying, you know, maybe we're going to, you know, take your firearms away. I think that'd be a stretch too. But there's got to be some consequence to that. And maybe just the publicity that this is getting or will get will be the consequence that they need.
Yeah, it's a wake-up call. Yeah,
it certainly will be. When we come back after the break, we're going to go up north to Boise, Idaho, and get a take on the Chad Daybell trial. Rusty, that trial started this week. We had opening statements. We had one witness, and we had Adam Small from KSL Radio, who was there.
KSL at night. KSL at night.
And you're back with us on KSL at night alongside Rusty Cannon. I'm your KSL legal analyst, Greg Skordis, and we're going to talk about a legal case that I think has been saturated pretty well.
It's been around.
But I just can't get it out of my mind. I had the pleasure, I guess, of going to Boise this week, Ada County, sitting in the courthouse there and watching the opening statements. And I sat by a dear friend of mine, Adam Small, KSL News Radio reporter, who's going to join us for this segment. And just kind of, for me, Rusty, I'm a trial lawyer. I go to court. I don't watch court. I don't like watch other attorneys, except when I'm waiting for my name to be called. But it's not like I sit down and watch a trial. Mm-hmm. And so it's been interesting for me to see this trial unfold, you know, from the legal perspective, just to kind of like, and it's like when you watch a movie and you see lawyers, you go, I would never do that. I would never do that. But I'm watching these lawyers, prosecutor, which I did for 8 years, defense attorney, which I've done for 34 years. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of like, well, you know, what would I have done? How would I have reacted to this? And it's really been an interesting process. But I'm kind of looking at it from that angle. Mm-hmm. We have with us Adam Small, KSL News Radio reporter, who's going to talk to us from the, I guess, more objective person on the street standpoint. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Greg, Rusty, good to be with you. And Greg, if it means anything, I've got pretty much every courtroom, you know, knowledge I have from suits. So this is a learning experience for me, too.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Harvey
okay.
Specter. Yeah, love
so,
suits.
So, Adam, talk to us, because I have my take, and you've probably heard it. What you saw in the opening remarks, were you surprised? Did you feel like And did you feel like, and I think you were there for some of Lori Vallow's trial, but what did you think about the opening remarks?
Well, I thought the state, it almost seemed like a continuation. Like, you know, it seemed like they took their a little more time establishing their case, like when you and I were talking up there. It seemed like they took a little bit more time, you know, setting up their case and opening statements for Lori's case last year versus this year. It kind of just seems like a continuation. Like, it's almost like, you know, part two, hey, we've talked about some of this before. Obviously, it's a brand new jury, but it seems like they didn't take as much time, and they're like, hey, and, you know, we have our case set. This is what we're going to go over, but it didn't take as much time to actually outline their entire case. I don't think their opening statements were necessarily like bad or anything. I just think like they got straight to the point. Like I think Rob Wood, the Madison County prosecutor, took what, 10, 20 minutes tops. And John Pryor, Chad's attorney, I was particularly impressed with his defense because, as we had been talking, you know, Lori's attorneys in her trial were relying on the state having a, you know, just their case wasn't strong enough, and that was really their whole defense. John Pryor came out with, I've got an expert from Boise State who's going to talk DNA, fingerprints. I got four of Tammy Daybell and Chad Daybell's kids are going to come to the stand. And I also thought he did a very good job in his position of trying to create a reasonable doubt when there seems to be so much evidence against Chad in this case. I was particularly impressed with him.
Adam, can I go back to the state's opening with you for just a minute? Because I loved your take. He started with the sort of Chad being this author and the writing these books and whatnot. And then his opening followed chapters. He said chapter one was sort of Chad with Tammy and their five children, but that wasn't very interesting. Chapter two, Lori comes into it, and then it proceeds from there. Did you find that compelling? Did you think that was sort of an interesting way to do it?
I thought it was interesting for sure. I still think it was compelling. I'd say the most compelling thing that I heard the prosecution bring forward was the closing arguments in Lori's trial last year, where they just kept going. They re-showed a couple of the autopsy photos. Like, you know, they went over some of that evidence again. That was very raw to hear. This one wasn't quite as much because they're now just getting into presenting evidence. But I do think it was compelling because it seemed like almost like a I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. But like they noted that, again, Chad was an author. And Rob was basically like, OK, well, I'm going to set this up like a novel for you guys. Like, he's going right at Chad, like. And he starts off with the phrase, three dead bodies. And yeah, it maybe slows down a little bit as he goes over chapter by chapter. But I still think he did a pretty good job at actually setting up the, hey, these kids are dead because XYZ. This woman, this school librarian, is dead because XYZ. Maybe a little bit slower at times, but I still think it was compelling, in my opinion.
And then, Adam, you talked about Pryor, the defense attorney's opening statement. And he outlined four experts, and as I recall, there is a DNA expert, there's an anthropological forensic expert who's going to talk about sort of the bones and whatnot was found, and a medical examiner, which I assume, Adam, is going to rebut the state's medical examiner as it relates to the cause of death of Tammy. And I'm just sort of reading between the lines. And then there was an expert on I'll think of it just a minute. Fingerprints. So, but did it surprise you that the defense was calling that number of experts and give you the impression that, hey, they're in this all the way? They're going after the state's case?
Yeah, I was definitely surprised for sure. And maybe it's just because, you know, my first real trial experience was Lori's trial last year when, again, the defense didn't call a single witness. They didn't present anything. They just it kind of shocked us in the newsroom. I remember the day it happened where they're like, yep, defense rests, like, we don't think the state has a strong case. So when John Pryor comes out and he's like, I've got, you know, this doctor from Boise State University, he's going to talk about DNA fingerprints, and he's going to testify to you that Chad, not a single DNA or fingerprint on anything was Chad's or anything like that. And he's like, I'm going to bring in, you know, four of their kids who's going to talk about you know, Tammy's health before she died, and that apparently she was trying some things or didn't want to go to the doctor. At least that's what they're claiming. And it comes up with three or four people. And on top of that, he's using like a logical argument to try to create doubt when he's looking the jury right in the eye. It definitely caught me off guard, because for how much evidence there is in this case, for how tangled of a web it is, and how, in at least in Lori's case, they already outlined a lot of stuff that they accused Chad of being involved in. It was surprisingly strong, and that it I feel like John Pryor has done as good of a job as you can of actually creating doubt, because that is his whole job in this thing. So yeah, it was definitely caught me off guard.
So I have a question both for you, Greg, and for Adam, as myself, someone who always wished he would have went to law school, and my wealth of knowledge is only from Suits. And then the movie that taught me that I apparently stand up at some point and say, did you or did you not order the code red? Right. That's my extent of knowledge. But
right.
Is there a strategy as to how many cards you lay on the table for both sides at this point? I don't know. Did they show all their cards or do you not do that?
If that's all right, Adam. I really think that, and I'll be interested in Adam's sort of response to this, but I really think opening statements, you need to come out and show the jury your case. You need to tell them what you're going to do. I was disappointed with the state for going through the chapter thing. Mm-hmm. When I was a prosecutor, I would tell the jury, here are my witnesses and here's what they're going to say. Here's the evidence that you're going to hear, instead of Chad was this, chapter one was this, then Lori comes in. So I think, to me, but I don't know. I mean, Adam might find the other approach different, but to me, openings, you don't leave anything on the table. What do you think, Adam, in terms of what the state did?
Yeah, I agree with you a little bit on that point, because, like, obviously, definitely not saying it was weak or anything. I do, the compelling nature was still there. But yeah, that was one thing too. When I looked back at the witnesses, the only witness that they named before they called their first witness to the stand, Detective Hermosillo, the Rexburg Police Department, the only one they named was Alex Cox, who's Lori's deceased brother, who's accused of being a co-conspirator. His widow, his wife, is going to take the stand. But they didn't really name anyone else outside of an FBI agent or maybe some other law enforcement. And yeah, I feel like at times, like, you know, if you want to set up an argument and come out strong out of the gates, I'm not saying I necessarily would lead with a chapter set up. While I get where they were going, I think at times it's like, if you set it up like a novel, sometimes there's a part of the book that comes off a little slower when, you know, there are times where they come out right out of the gate, three dead bodies, maybe it slows down, you start to lose that momentum a little bit, when I felt like John Pryor specifically did not lay off the gas pedal. And I think that was kind of the difference between the two.
Exactly. Adam, I wish we had some time. I wanted to ask you about your take on Hermosillo. We'll save that for next time. And thank you for being with us this evening.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL Night. I'm Rusty Cannon. I'm here with Greg Skordas, the one and only. And Greg, as you know, folks can keep up to speed on the breaking news out there by getting texts on their phone. Just text the word breaking, BREAKING, to 57500. So if you're walking through the store or wherever you may be, you can make sure that you are in the know. And ready for that. But thank you, everybody, for joining us.
I've been using it, actually.
I
enjoy it. Yeah, every once in a while you get something that's kind of interesting, and just keeping in touch. It's fun.
Good to have. And speaking of breaking news, we've had a lot of action in Washington, D.C. this week with a bill having to do with FISA. And if I get the acronym right, it's Washington, D.C., so it's some sort of acronym, right?
Sure.
Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, reauthorization that comes up every few years. And we've got joining with us Perry Russum, is an ABC News correspondent in Washington, D.C. Perry, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, of course.
So tell us what's going on there. I have watched all kinds of news headlines, various tweets, or I'm sorry, X now. I still want to call it tweets from elected officials in Utah. What is going on with this bill in D.C.?
Yeah, so there's kind of this ticking time clock with FISA, especially Section 702 that House
the House has been looking at today and actually did vote to approve it. So now it goes to the Senate, but there's a little bit of some procedural issues. So there, it's slowly working its way to the Senate. But FBI Director Christopher Wray was at the Capitol yesterday talking about the importance of getting 702 approved. There was some infighting in Congress about whether 702 should have a warrant or not. And Section 702 is the U.S.'s way to listen in on non-Americans overseas without a warrant. But the issue is that with that, some Americans were having their communication looked at without a warrant. So there was pushback from both Republicans and Democrats about this warrant, with Congressman Briggs putting an amendment in to try and push a warrant through. But that actually tied. It was pretty dramatic. It was 212 to 212 and House Speaker Mike Johnson voting against it. So it still stands as it is with no warrant. But the big push was to get this done as soon as possible, because 702 expires next Friday.
So it expires next Friday. If I read correctly, there could be a vote to reconsider. I know the vote was 212 to 212, but would that be on the amendment on the warrant?
It's right. So one of the representatives from Florida requested a vote to reconsider this whole entire legislation on that FISA bill so that it won't go to the Senate until the House votes to table the motion to reconsider the vote next week. So now this kind of gets kicked to next week, but it seems like this warrant really is the hang up, because the vote on the bill as it was, you know, was pretty overwhelming in favor. So it seems like this warrant is still the main issue here.
Yeah, it's interesting. But we have four members of Congress from Utah. Three voted against the amendment, one voted for it. Obviously, that came into play, 212 to 212. But we can talk about that later. What happens next at this point?
Right. So they're going to have this procedural vote next week, it seems. And then whatever happens with that, it will then go to the Senate. But, you know, there was the White House whipping votes today against this Briggs amendment. You know, Christopher Wray yesterday was highly against this warrant. And one of the issues that he was bringing up is there's just not enough time in some of these situations to go and ask for a warrant. One of the Republican congressmen yesterday saying, just ask for a warrant. And Wray was point blank saying, you know, it would be great to get a warrant, but in some cases you don't. It's a race against time. And for some of these issues, they're trying to put out as quickly as possible. They just want to get this information and see what's going on with what people are talking about.
So former President Donald Trump also weighed in on this issue. Can you talk about that? I know there may be some dynamics today with he and Speaker Johnson. I don't think their get together was specifically about this, but anything new on that?
Right. So the Speaker Johnson, former President Trump meeting today was about election interference, and they were trying to tie that to the southern border. But the real headlines coming out of that today was former President Trump backing Speaker Johnson as Johnson starts to face, you know, pushback from conservative Republicans in Congress, specifically Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was looking to oust Johnson as Speaker. But, you know, Trump's saying today that Johnson's doing a really good job under very tough circumstances. He says they're getting along very well, and he says that he stands with the Speaker, at the same time calling Greene a good friend.
And Perry, is the push behind this FISA being done by the Justice Department? Because it seems like Trump is saying kill FISA. The Biden administration doesn't seem all that worked up about it. Who's pushing this?
Yeah, so Trump's getting worked up about FISA because he believes that FISA affected him in some of his investigations. But there was a Republican congressman on the Hill yesterday saying he doesn't think Trump fully understands how FISA works. But House Speaker Mike Johnson is in favor of keeping FISA as it is. And that was really upsetting some of the conservative Republicans yesterday and today. I mean, yeah, today Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying outside of the Capitol that there's no difference in leadership styles between Johnson, who's a Republican, and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's a Democrat.
And is the distinction, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, so I understand the whole warrantless searches, is that if you're a U.S. citizen, a U.S. person, that a warrant is required, whereas if you're not, there's an exception? I guess I'm missing the warrantless part.
No. Yeah, it's so easy to get lost in the weeds on this, right? So Section 702 authorizes the intelligence agencies to look at non-Americans overseas, look at their communications, look at that without a warrant. And it also allows them to look at Americans' communication who are talking to a foreign target without a warrant. And Wray yesterday is saying this information we have is already collected. It's not like we're listening in on calls. We're just trying to see, you know, if there's any immediate threat.
Yeah, Perry, that's the one thing I was trying to straighten out of my mind, and I think you've talked about it a bit, is what is this really about? Apparently, so it's a database, calls, texts, you name it, to where if they want to go and search that database, the idea is, do you need a warrant to do that if it is in consideration of a U.S. citizen? Is that correct?
Right. So the big hang up from, you know, civil liberties groups, as well as, you know, Republicans and Democrats, is you should not, they're saying you should not be able to look at this information without a warrant if it involves an American. But Ray is saying sometimes with these situations, we need to look at this information as quickly as possible. And the thing that he was highlighting yesterday on the Hill was, you know, we're at a time with national security. We have so many different things happening at once. He's saying it's the busiest it's been in recent memory that he can think of, with, you know, terror threats coming in left and right from some of these terrorist groups over in the Middle East, that they need to have every faucet of information open as much as possible.
So the timeline of next Friday, this also has to go to the Senate, right? We actually have a senator from Utah that's been quite vocal on this issue. Let's say this goes over to the Senate without the warrant amendment. What happens at that point in the Senate, and do they also need to get this figured out before next Friday?
Yeah, everything has to get done by next Friday. So whatever the House decides on, whether it has the warrant or no warrant, the Senate then votes on that. And then once that vote happens, I mean, if they go against what the House is doing, then we go back to square one. But if they approve what the House does, then it goes to the president. So once we get to next week, that ticking clock really starts to go down. And Ray seemed pretty concerned yesterday, the FBI director, about getting this done, because he does not want to see this lapse at all.
What has the White House told us? What is the Biden administration? How have they weighed in so far?
So they want to keep FISA as it currently stands without a warrant. And then once this Briggs Amendment came in today, the one that was really pushing to get a warrant in there, the White House was quickly calling congressmen and women saying, don't vote for this amendment. Don't vote for the amendment. Don't vote for the amendment. This all happened really rapidly. And as you're watching the vote come in, you can see the numbers starting to get even and even and even. So they want to keep FISA as it currently stands. And the conservative Republicans did get a win yesterday where, you know, FISA was going to be renewed for 5 years, but the way they were able to reconfigure it, so now it's just going to be renewed for 2 years. And their thinking on that is, if it can get renewed for 2 years, that buys the intelligence agencies some time. And they're also hoping that President Trump wins the election. So then when he's in office, he can kind of control and reconfigure FISA the way he wants it.
Well, Perry, this has been amazing. You've taken a very complicated issue and made it very understandable. We appreciate you joining us. Perry Russman, ABC News correspondent in Washington, D.C., thank you for joining us. And folks, thank you for sticking with us here on KSL Night. We will be right back after this break.
KSL at Night.
And you're back with us on KSL at Night alongside Rusty Cannon. I'm your host this evening, Greg Skordis. And Rusty, I don't know if you remember, of course you remember, in 2021, a young couple driving through Utah, sort of a trip of a lifetime. They've got this cute little van they're driving around in. Gabby Petito and her fiance, Brian Laundrie, they get stopped by Moab police after they appeared to have had a fight. And it was clear that something was up there. The police, you watch the video of the police talking to each of them and really feel like, and I hope I'm not coming across as biased, that the police were trying to de-escalate the situation. They were trying to do what they could to make sure that these two were safe, that Gabby was going to be safe, that Brian Laundrie was going to be safe. They did separate them for a while. Unfortunately, it ended up horribly. She is dead. She's missing for some time. Brian Laundrie drives back to Florida. They later find Gabby has been murdered. He commits suicide in Florida and is obviously the cause of her death. So recently, Florida has passed a law where police officers are required to do what's called a lethality assessment. Now, I think Utah requires officers to do that too, and I'm not sure whether that was in place at the time of this specific incident, but I think it is now. But to help us sort of understand the law, what this lethality assessment means, we are joined this evening by Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent in Los Angeles. Alex, thank you for joining us this evening.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
We're great. So tell us what Florida did and what law enforcement is required to do now that they weren't required to do before.
Yeah, this is something that, at least in the current form that it is in Florida, is somewhat unique. There are other versions of it in other states, and Utah does have a version of it as well. But this was really pushed by Gabby Petito's family, and they're trying to get all states to do this. That essentially what Florida is saying is that when a police officer arrives on the scene of a domestic violence situation, that there will be 12 very specific questions on domestic violence calls that they then have to ask by law. And, you know, a lot like reading Miranda rights, I assume that they will keep it in their pocket and then pull it out and say, okay, I've got to ask you these, and then go through from there. And this was really the Petito family pushing it. This is Gabby's mom saying,
I can say that if they had used a lethality assessment, I'm certain my daughter would be alive today. They just need more training.
And she's talking about the Moab police officers there, and that this is really a series of questions. In Florida's case, it'll be, did the aggressor ever use a weapon against you? Have you ever been choked by your aggressor? That they want these police officers, when they arrive on scene on any call, if it is domestic violence, try to better understand if a victim is in danger, what the likelihood is that they're going to go from there and then be murdered. I mean, it's gruesome, but are they going to go and be murdered? And Gabby Petito's mom saying,
I think it would have opened up a door for her to be able to tell them what was really going on. So many people have a Gabby in their life, a loved one, and they might not even know they're going through something, but that's why it's important to learn the signs and ask the questions and just be there for them.
So the law is going to take effect in Florida in 3 months. And critics say, and there are those pushing back against it, that this puts too much pressure on street cops for it to be them deciding, is this person going to be in danger of being murdered? And did they go through these 12 questions, and then the officer asked to determine, based on the answers, what they do moving forward? Victims don't have to answer them. Some police groups are saying, look, hire domestic violence experts who respond to these calls with armed police instead of making police do this on top of everything else they have to do. But supporters are saying, look, the reality of it right now is that when you call 911, it's going to be patrol officers who show up, and they are the first responders to get there, and they have to decide what they're going to do. And there's a lot of criticism over what Moab police and the other agencies who are with them, what they did and didn't do, and there was fallout from that. Some who don't believe that they did enough or knew what questions to ask or what to do. So this is something that they want to spread to more states. And I believe you're right. I'm looking at a number of questions that first responders are given in Utah, it appears. 11 questions, yes and no, or not answered, to go down the checklist. These are a little bit different what Florida is doing, but generally same idea.
So, Alex, what happens after these questions are asked? I guess in the case of Florida, I mean, you mentioned that puts quite a bit of a burden on the officers. Are there next steps outlined in the law, or is it just simply up to the officers after that?
Well, generally, it's going to be, at least in Florida, up to the officers to say, okay, here's what the answers were. What do we do next? The questions are meant to elicit answers that may give them some idea and the appropriate questions to ask to know moving forward that, you know, what they asked her in Moab may not have been the correct answer to question to get the answer that could really inform them of what that next step may have been. Now, you know, after the fact, we can discuss that they should have done this, should have done that. There may have been nothing that they could have done. They did separate them that night. Brian Laundrie went to a hotel, she stayed in the van, and then they on their own came back together. But maybe there was something that they could do, and that's where victims' rights advocates are saying that there may have been, whether it had been arresting one of them because they both claimed that they had been assaulting the other, or separating them for longer, or filing charges, or making them go a longer distance away, whatever that would have been. The other part of it is a victim doesn't have to answer these questions in Florida. They're not mandated to answer them. But, again, these victim rights advocates are saying, and domestic violence groups are saying, yeah, but based on asking the right questions, it may get a victim thinking about these things in their own mind and okay, maybe I am in danger. If you're talking about, have you ever been choked? Was there ever a weapon involved? Asking the right things may get the wheels turning a little bit so that they know that they're in danger, even if police are gone and they haven't asked questions, trying to get the ball rolling a little bit to get them help. that you know, that oftentimes they may not answer them, but they may help themselves.
And Alex, it seems to me that in Utah, at least, before the lethality assessment became part of the officer's protocol, they at least separated the parties, and they did that here. I assume that, and that wasn't even a judgment call on the part of police officers. It's always seemingly been the case, at least since the legislation was passed here in Utah. Does the lethality assessment, let's say you check the boxes and you get five yeses and three noes, or five and seven, whatever. I mean, I assume it takes a little bit of the subjectivity out of it for law enforcement and say, look, if you get, so you know, 8 out of 12 yeses, maybe you need to take one of the parties away.
Yeah, and a lot of that will be training that goes into it, and what the state decides to do with this law, that it is not in effect yet. Yes, but a lot of it will be what the answers are as well. That, yeah, you can have a checklist of yes and no, but some of it's going to be what are those answers? Not just a yes and no, but, you know, explaining, well, yeah, he did have a weapon, and here's how he or she used it or threatened me with it, or, you know, what some of the situation is. Things to kind of spark what the need is going to be for that next step, instead of just showing up and not really knowing, not all patrol officers knowing the right questions to ask. And just kind of overall seeing the situation and being, well, you know, both parties were aggressive toward each other. Yeah, just don't be together tonight and then move on. But to really inform, you know, think about DUI laws over the years and what officers have learned about DUI assessment and how to evaluate. Didn't used to be that way. It used to be kind of more an officer showed up and went, you generally look all right. And you let them drive or not drive or take their keys or, you know, tell them to pick it up in the morning. That doesn't fly any longer. And the training has, and realizing the signs, it's all progressed. And this is, you know, like that of realizing those signs and knowing when there's danger.
Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent in Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us this evening.
You got it. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
And that really is interesting, Rusty, that we have these lethality assessments. I talked to a victim advocate recently who was really at the forefront of Utah having that. Mm-hmm. And law enforcement hasn't pushed back on it. I mean, it's another tool for them, but it's also another burden for them. Like mm-hmm. he said, like reading the Miranda rights, you got the lethality assessment. But yeah, I think it's good. I think it's something that maybe nationwide we're going to see. When we come back after the break, something right up your alley. Five things to know about tax deadline.
Yes, tax time's coming.
Just around the corner. Yep. Stay with us.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL Tonight. I am Rusty Cannon. I'm here with Greg Skordas. And Greg, as you know, there is something coming on Monday. Tax deadline is coming, the good old April 15th. Are you ready?
I want to just tell you something, Rusty, and maybe you can talk about this. April 15th means nothing to me, and I'll tell you why.
Oh,
I always get an extension. October 15th is drop dead date. My accountant is like, Skordas, I don't have time for you. You know, pay your quarterlies, pay your advances, do what you need to do. We'll get around to it. I'm kind of low priority there. But of course, it doesn't mean it goes away.
No.
It just means October 15th, I'm scrambling like a lot of people are now. There's penalties, obviously, mm-hmm. postponing. It doesn't do you any good. But I just, my tax guy is like,
do it later.
He's got other things going on.
Yeah.
Right now.
Well, you're in the same camp with a lot of Americans. So there's some interesting statistics out there. As of right now, about this point in time, the IRS has received about 90 million tax returns. They expect to receive about 50 million more in the last 2 weeks. And so this is a little bit of some old numbers, but right. to give you some perspective, about half are done electronically at this point, and about half do it the other way. And, or excuse me, I had that wrong. About half are done with tax professionals and half are done by do-it-yourselfers. So you're in about a camp with about half folks. But one thing that was going to trip a lot of people up that I thought everybody should be aware of was under ARPA, if you remember the American Rescue Plan Act, some of the craziness that went on during COVID, there was a proposed rule that was going to come out to where if anybody was selling stuff, like on eBay or Etsy, let's say you're selling paintings of trees on Etsy, that if you had sold more than $600 worth of stuff in 2023, they were going to be required to send you a 1099. Meaning if you had just sold, you know, some stuff from your garage or whatever the case may be, online and added up through one of these platforms to more than $600 in 2023, they were going to make them send you a 1099 to where you'd owe, you know, to pay tax on any gains on that. That was going to trip some people up.
Yeah. How is that related to ARPA? I mean, that doesn't seem
it's
like...
It's not.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was just wondering. It just got thrown in the bill.
Yeah, well, it was part of the diatribe that was going on at the time of going after, you know, tax cheats or what have you, and letting everybody pay their fair share, right? You know, you're kind of that Bernie Sanders line. But it was the idea behind it is to just catch people that should be paying taxes when they're not, because the actual threshold right now is $20,000. So you're a serious seller, right? If you're selling $20,000 worth of stuff, typically on these online platforms, you're serious about it. But $600, I mean, that was the point of everybody putting up quite a stink after this came out.
And what you're not paying taxes on $600. You're paying taxes on your
just the
profit.
Gains.
Yeah, the gain. Yeah. So if you bought a bicycle, let's say, for $500 and you sold it for $600, I guess you're going to get something. You have to show your where you are at the beginning.
Paperwork nightmare. That's why there was such a fit. Yeah, it makes zero sense at all. You wonder, you know, why. So thankfully, they postponed it.
eBay are going to send out, or they probably have sent out 1099s then to individuals that sold?
Well, thankfully, they backtracked. And so it's on hold as of right now for 2023. But now we're in 2024, and they are going to move that down to $5,000 for 2024, according to what's out there. So it's getting a little more intense, but not the $600 level, but the $5,000 at this point. That's the current status. So if they do push this through eventually to $600, it's ridiculous. It's just tripping over pennies.
I can't even imagine the paperwork for something like that.
No, it's a nightmare.
And then so people are going to say, forget it. I'm not going to use... And I guess, you know, KSL.com is a little different because we don't sell it through them. It's just introducing buyers to sellers.
Correct. Yeah, this is through platforms.
Yeah, okay, that makes some sense.
Yeah, platforms. And so that's one thing that everybody needs to be aware of. I mean, you know, all kinds of other issues. You're essentially, you know, doing your quarterly, self-employed, those types of things. For everybody else with children, things have also changed in 2023, where that child tax credit that got really ramped up during COVID, that's come back down. A lot of people are going to see slightly higher taxes due to that. So there's a report we actually do at the Utah Taxpayers Association. It'll be out next week. We call it the Beehive Family, where we look at the typical Utah family and quantify all their taxes that they owe. And it's really pretty revealing. And new report will be out next week just after tax time. But it's interesting to show Utah families what their biggest tax burdens are. And it usually is an eye-opener. Most people don't know what their biggest, what do you think the biggest tax burden families face as far as federal or state? What would be your guess?
Property?
Property is close. The biggest one, over half of the taxes they pay, Social Security, Medicare, payroll tax. So it comes out of everybody's check, right?
Right. Oh,
so if you're self-employed, you're remitting all 15.3%. As a self-employment tax. But if you work for an employer, half of it is hidden and paid by the employer. And then the other half, about 7.65 is taken out of your paycheck right off the bat, gross amount right off the bat. Every worker pays it. And we can go on forever about how problematic the Social Security and Medicare systems are. They're going bankrupt. But that is by
Don't
far.
Say that.
Sorry. Yeah, it was.
I just turned.
Oh yeah. It's something to worry about. I mean, that's the biggest burden. But then on a state level, yes, some of the highest property tax, sales tax, and income tax is actually quite high. That's as well, because you get less deductions and credits on your state income tax versus federal. So it's really eye-opening.
It seems like in the state of Utah, Rusty, and you probably know more as much about this as anyone, we've actually had some budget surpluses to the point where the legislature has... I don't know whether they've actually enacted or considered or have done some reductions here in Utah. Mm-hmm.
They have. Yeah. So what's been good about, how long has it been since 2007? So 17 years. We were the cool kid on the block where under Governor Huntsman, we went to a flat tax at 5%. That was a big deal. It got us lower into a flat rate. Now, since then, most other states have started to follow that and get on that bandwagon. And not only have they followed it, they've got ahead of Utah.
In what respect?
The rates are lower than Utah's.
Five?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, but now we have in recent years...
A flat tax of 5% income for state taxes?
Correct.
Okay.
But now, then we moved to 495. And then as of this legislative session, we just went down to 4.55. So we've moved it all the way down.
Significantly.
Yeah,
yes.
Significantly. So if you add that up annually, that's... somewhere between $600 to $700 million a year annually now that is back in taxpayer pockets due to the legislature, which is a big deal. So that's been good. And they've done some reductions. So that's part of what they've done with the surplus, surpluses that they've had. The other thing they've done is they've given a massive amount of that surplus to education. Despite all of the beating up that the legislators take on, you know, not doing enough for education, that is absolutely not true. And anybody that takes an honest look at those numbers should know that they have done an amazing job at pumping billions more into education over the last 5 to 7 years. And so that's an important thing to know. That's what they've done in answer to your question with that surplus.
Do you see other ways where we're going to be doing things? And we're kind of digressing a little bit from taxes. I mean, we consider sales tax on food every year. We consider other I don't know, like property tax. We consider certain things. Where are we headed in this state? Because some states, you know, you look at Nevada and there's no income tax, or I don't know. At least that's what they say.
Yeah, there's a big conversation coming for this fall on the ballot. And we'll talk about this on another show. Well, we can spend a lot of time talking about it. There'll be a constitutional amendment on the ballot that will do two things. If it passes, it will remove the state sales tax on food. And so that's a big deal. It will be
a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, because if the constitutional amendment passes, the state sales tax on food will come off. What the constitutional amendment does is it will remove the earmark on income tax revenue. The earmark currently says income tax revenue can only be used for education, K-12 and higher education. And the constitutional amendment is to remove that firewall. Every other state in the nation doesn't have that firewall. It's just Utah that has it. So that will be a very interesting topic. I'm glad you brought that up. We'll definitely have to dig into that on another time. But again, we're going to move on to some other subjects tonight. Thank you. That's a great discussion on taxes. Don't forget April 15th.
I need to pick your brain more on this.
Oh, we've got plenty of time to do it, and then we'll do a lot more of it. Thank you for joining us on KSL at Night. We will be right back.
KSL at Night.
You're back with us on KSL at Night. I'm with Rusty Cannon. My name is Greg Skordis. And Rusty, I learned off air that we both have something in common. We both work at Weber County Ski Resorts part-time on the weekends.
We do.
I work at Powder Mountain on their ski patrol, and you work at Snow Basin. Yeah. In what capacity?
Mountain safety up there. Green coats, as we're known.
Okay, because I always think of mountain safety as us, the patrol, but you're...
Yeah, no, we're a step down, I would say. We're the green coats monitoring a certain area of the resort, so...
So we were... last Sunday was our last day. It was snowing. It was freezing cold. We were skiing Powder the last day, and I thought, why are we closing? And then I talked to you today, and you told me why we should close.
Yeah, I was up there yesterday at Snow Basin, and you might as well have had water skis at the base at the end of the day. But top half of the mountain was good, and until about 11 o'clock, then it gets really sticky, and you know, when your skis start catching and you're kind of going over to the tips as it hits the brakes, whether you like it or not. So
Well, let's bring in our KSL meteorologist, Kevin Eubank. Kevin, thank you for joining us this evening on KSL at Night.
Of course. How are you two?
We're doing great. So what's the forecast for the ski industry for this next couple of days? It seemed like we were looking at potential for record heat.
Yeah, it's fantastic. First off, let's just praise what we do have, which is incredible amounts of snow up in the mountains of Utah. So Alts has had its second consecutive 600-plus inch year, which is phenomenal. And we've got a lot of snow up in the mountains. But as Rusty just said, with these kind of warm temperatures, it doesn't take long for that to become mush and just turn into massive problems. So it's really an interesting formula. You're trying to balance the appetite to still be up there skiing and snowboarding, along with the conditions, the safety, and the ability of the mountain operations to continue. So a lot of the resorts have closed. I mean, Beaver Mountain is closed for the year, Eagle Point, Nordic Valley, Powder Mountain, Sundance, you know, they're all closed. But there are several resorts that are still planning to be open all the way into the month of May. So Solitude and Snowbird have both said, hey, we're staying open. And so that it's incredible what Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon can do. They get a little bit different temperature profile than some of the Weber Canyon or the Weber County resorts. But I think we'll be snowboarding and skiing at least at a couple of resorts all the way through April and into the month of May.
You know, Kevin, the Snow Basin is going to shift to earlier hours, I believe, on Sunday. People need to check their website to make sure, but kind of an 8 to 2 time frame. But as they start to transition towards ending the season, is it too early to think about flooding issues or water runoff issues, or when do we start to see that picture?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our snowpack generally peaks at April 1st, and our runoff generally starts to peak around the 1st of May. So we're a little bit early, and today's temperatures, we're in the low 80s today. So we've had near record-breaking temperatures. It's not going to last. Next week, we flip the switch. We bring in some storms. We drop temperatures into the 50s. Lows in the valleys go into the 30s, and that's going to keep a lot more snow and colder temperatures up in our mountains. But the truth is anytime you've got a lot of water, weather becomes a determining factor for how fast that water can come down. Last year, it was perfect. It warmed up and then it cooled down, and we brought that snowpack down gradually. This year, I think we'll experience something very similar. We are not anticipating significant flooding issues. We've got not only the snowpack, but we've got the capacity in the reservoirs, lakes, and streams to manage that snowpack. So yes, there will be some localized flooding. That's inevitable. In Utah, we do that. But I don't think we're going to see widespread flooding. I think we're going to be able to handle and take care of what we currently have.
Yeah, and Kevin, I'm one of those weather geeks that looks at the KSL.com weather outlook and the Utah snowpack totals, and I'm looking at the severe basin, lower severe, upper severe, who at both of those areas are well above or at least in the 150% range. Is that, and Escalante is 178% of normal. What's going on in that part of the state?
So let me tell you what happens. When it gets this time of year and we still have a lot of snow in our mountains, it starts to skew the averages, because generally over a 30-year period, you would have started to melt that snow off. So in anomalously wet years, the snowpack data really gets kind of skewed after April 1st. So I'm going to tell you, your friends, or anyone else who loves to watch snowpack, take it with a grain of salt after April 1st. Yesterday was the last time I'll show that on TV, because it becomes really a skewed statistic. And it only takes about 3 weeks for things to really regulate, because once you get the warmth, it'll start bringing those basin numbers down a little bit closer to average. But the truth is, we finished snow season and snowpack season 134% of normal for a statewide average. Incredible. Such a blessing to have that kind of water in our mountains coming off of a record-breaking year last year. It just allows us to do tons of good things. We're going to see a 40 to 50-foot rise on Lake Powell. We're going to see a 2 to 3-foot rise on the Great Salt Lake. And we're going to fill 90% of the state reservoirs to capacity, and the outliers are going to be places like Flaming Gorge, Bear Lake, and Lake Powell that, you know, are going to take multiple years to fill. But it's just a perfect recipe to do what we need to do in the desert state of Utah to get the water in the winter and then to use it all summer long.
So, Kevin, now you have me daydreaming. I'm sitting on a houseboat in Lake Powell. you brought up that. Tell us a little more about Lake Powell. I haven't been down there in a while, but how many feet did you say that's going
to
rise?
Feet?
Yeah.
Yeah. So right now, we're currently 30 feet above where we were last year at this time at Lake Powell. So incredible height. Now, again, we're only 33% of capacity at Lake Powell. We have so much more water that can go into that lake, that needs to go into that lake. And with good management over the next decades, we will help get that reservoir, that lake, back to a healthy level. But this year, we're going to end the year projected 18 to 19 feet above last year's mark, which means we're going to come up 40 to 50 feet from where we are right now. Right now is generally April to the 1st of May is the lowest spot at Lake Powell. We haven't started getting the Colorado River running yet, and we've been letting out water all winter long as mandated by the federal government. So we're at the lowest point in the middle to the end of April. Then in May, we start to climb because the runoff starts coming in. So when we use that low mark right now as kind of the low mark basis, we're anticipating getting up above 3,600 feet elevation, which is going to be a 40 to 50 feet increase from where we are today.
And Kevin, Rusty and I talking about skiing, I guess sort of a good news, bad news. Utah is known for its light, fluffy powder, but it seems like this year, especially later in the year, and maybe it's always the case, we had a little more water content to our snow, which is good for the water. Maybe not quite the snow we're used to in Utah. Is that a something that you recognize, or just something that I saw while I was up skiing? It just seemed like it was wetter this year.
No, exactly. So let me identify for our audience who we love and value, KSL. What we have here on the phone today are two snow snobs. Okay, I just want you all to know. I want you all to recognize Greg and Rusty are snow snobs. Okay,
that's so right. If it's cloudy, I'm
the
out.
Winter, and now they're starting to go, well, usually it's really powdery, Kevin, and this year it was kind of Sierra cement. Well, you're exactly right. It's so true, Greg. What we had this year, we had a series of atmospheric rivers that came in from the Pacific, and they came crashing into Utah, and they produced a very heavy wet snow. So generally, our snow ratio, 10 to 1. 1 inch of water equals 10 inches of snow. This year, we ended up with a 5 to 7 to 1 general ratio, which means that you're getting a lot more water in that one or in that 10 inches of snow. And so it's a heavier snow. It's a more dense snow. It compacts faster. It's not that fluffy, light powder you love, and it stays for days. You can always go find a powder stash in the trees. Not this year. It sunk really fast and got hard really quick. And that was because these storms kept coming in from the west, instead of the north or the northwest, which are colder and they're a lighter density snowfall.
So, Kevin, we're about out of time, but just really quickly in closing, how does this ski forecast look next week, right? Really warm temperatures this week. Are you saying it'll be a little cooler if people do want to head up to some of those resorts next week that are still open?
Yes, it is going to be cooler by 20 to 25 degrees. We're going to get the light snowfall in the mountains, potentially 6 to 12 inches over the three-day period of Monday through Wednesday of next week. So next week is going to flip the table. We're not going to be in the 70s or 80s. We're going to be in the 50s with lows in the 30s in the valleys, which puts the resorts in the 20s for lows and highs in the 40s. Perfect spring skiing conditions.
You made a lot of skiers happy. Thanks so much, Kevin, for joining us tonight. I'm Rusty Cannon here with Greg Skordas, and thank you for joining us on KSL at Night.